Chapter 6. The Burgundians in the Middle Ages. It will be remembered from Chapter 3 that the conquest of the kingdom of the Burgundians was begun by Clovis and was completed by his sons in 532, and that in the quadruple division of the Frankish dominion in 561, Burgundy, with some additional counties in the north, fell to Gontran, who fixed his capital there. When the Frankish dominions, having been united under Charles Martel, were again divided between Pepin the Short and Carloman, Burgundy fell to the share of Pepin. And when Carloman became a monk and Pepin became king by the grace of Pope Zachary, of course Burgundy was but a province of his kingdom, as it was also of the empire of Charlemagne, the son of Pepin. In the division of the empire of Charlemagne, by the Treaty of Verdun, 843, Burgundy was included in the portion of the Emperor Lothair, which, it will be remembered, reached from the Mediterranean to the North Sea and included the Italian territory. In the time of Charles the Fat, 877, Burgundy became again independent, under Basso or Basson, husband of Ermengarde, the daughter of Emperor Louis II. This kingdom was called Provence, as well as Burgundy and sometimes Cisgiraine Burgundy. It included Provence, Dauphine, the southern part of Savoy, and the country between the Saône and the Jura Mountains. There was formed another kingdom of Burgundy on the other side of the Jura Mountains. This was called the Kingdom of Transjurane Burgundy and was founded by Count Rudolf in A.D. 888, and was recognized by the Emperor Arnulf the same year. It included the northern part of Savoy and all Switzerland between the Jura Mountains and the river Riuse. In 937, Rudolf's son, Rudolf, traded for the Cisgiraine Burgundy his rights to the Italian crown, and thus the two Burgundies, the Transjurane and the Cisgiraine, were united in one kingdom of Burgundy or Arles. This kingdom continued independent till A.D. 1032, when, in accordance with a treaty which had been made between the Emperor Henry II and Rudolf II, its last king, the kingdom of Burgundy was received into the empire by Emperor Conrad II, Rudolf III confirming it by will, as his niece Gisela was Conrad's wife. The emperor thus assumed the Burgundian crown, and this beautiful kingdom, full of prosperous cities, became a part of the empire. The kingdom of Burgundy, or Arles, comprehended the whole mountainous region which we now call Switzerland. It was accordingly reunited to the Germanic Empire by the bequest of Rodolf, along with the rest of his dominions. A numerous and ancient nobility, vassals one to another or to the empire, divided the possession with ecclesiastical lords hardly less powerful than themselves. Of the former we find the counts of Zaringen, Kyburg, Habsburg, and Tokenburg most conspicuous. Of the latter, the bishop of Coire, the abbot of St. Gall, and abbess of Seckingen. Every variety of feudal rights was early found and long preserved in Helvetia. Nor is there any country whose history better illustrates that ambiguous relation, half property and half dominion, in which the territorial aristocracy under the feudal system stood with respect to their dependents. In the 12th century, the Swiss towns rise into some degree of importance. Zurich was eminent for commercial activity and seems to have had no lord but the emperor. Basel, though subject to its bishop, possessed the usual privileges of municipal government. Bern and Freiburg, founded only in that century, made a rapid progress, and the latter was raised along with Zurich by Frederick II in 1218 to the rank of a free imperial city. In the northern part of what is now Switzerland, between Lake Constance and Lake Luzerne, and along the left bank of the Rhine, the Alemanni had settled when they first took the country from the Romans. The castle of Habsburg was possessed by Rudolf, the Alamannian nobleman who was made emperor in 1273. His ambitious descendants, the Dukes of Austria, endeavored to enlarge their authority and possessions at the expense of the cantons. Several changes in the principal Helvetian families took place in the 13th century, before the end of which the House of Habsburg, under the politic and enterprising Rodolf and his son Albert, became possessed through various titles of a great ascendancy in Switzerland. Of these titles, none was more tempting to an ambitious chief than that of advocate to a convent. That spacious name conveyed with it a kind of indefinite guardianship and right of interference, which frequently ended in reversing the conditions of the ecclesiastical sovereign and its vassal. Among other advocacies, Albert obtained that of some convents which had estates in the valleys of the Schweiz and Underwald. The people of Schweiz had made Rodolf their advocate. They distrusted Albert, whose succession to his father's inheritance spread alarm through Helvetia. It soon appeared that their suspicions were well-founded. Besides the local rights which his ecclesiastical advocacies gave him over part of the forest cantons, he pretended, after his election to the empire, to send imperial bailiffs into the valleys as administrators of criminal justice. Some authorities make Frederick III the one who sent these bailiffs, but whether it was Frederick or Albert, the facts are the same. One of these bailiffs was Gessler, whom William Tell resisted. Their oppression of a people unused to control, whom it was plainly the design of Albert to reduce into servitude, excited those generous emotions of resentment which a brave and simple race have seldom the discretion to repress. Three men, Stauffacher of Schweitz, First of Uri, Melchthal of Underwald, each with 10 chosen associates, met by night in a sequestered field, and swore to assert the common cause of their liberties, without bloodshed or injury to the rights of others. Their success was answerable to the justice of their undertaking. The three cantons unanimously took up arms and expelled their oppressors without a contest. Albert's assassination by his nephew, which followed soon afterwards, fortunately gave them leisure to consolidate their union, AD 1308. But Leopold, Duke of Austria, resolved to humble the peasants who had rebelled against his father, led a considerable force into their country. The Swiss, commending themselves to heaven, and determined rather to perish than undergo that yoke a second time, though ignorant of regular discipline, and unprovided with defensive armor, utterly discomfited the assailants at Morgarten. This great victory, the Marathon of Switzerland, confirmed the independence of the three original cantons. After some years, Lucerne, contiguous in situation and alike in interests, was incorporated into their confederacy. It was far more materially enlarged about the middle of the 14th century by the accession of Zurich, Glarus, Zug, and Bern, all of which took place within 2 years. The first and last of these cities had already been engaged in frequent wars with the Helvetian nobility, and their internal polity was altogether republican. They acquired not independence, which they already enjoyed, but additional security by this union with the Swiss, properly so called, who, in deference to their power and reputation, ceded to them the first rank in the league. The eight already enumerated are called the ancient cantons, and continued till the late reformation of the Helvetic system to possess several distinctive privileges and even rights of sovereignty over subject territories in which the five cantons of Freiburg, Solur, Basel, Schaffhausen, and Appenzell did not participate. From this time the united cantons, but especially those of Bern and Zurich, began to extend their territories at the expense of the rural nobility. The Helvetic cities acted with policy and moderation towards the nobles whom they overcame, admitting them to the franchises of their community as co-burghers, a privilege which virtually implied a defensive alliance against any assailant, and uniformly respecting the legal rights of property. Many feudal superiorities they obtained from the owners in a more peaceable manner, through purchases or mortgage. Thus the House of Austria, to which the extensive domains of the Counts of Kyburg had devolved, abandoning, after repeated defeats, its hopes of subduing the forest cantons, alienated a great part of its possessions to Zurich and Bern. And the last remnant of their ancient Helvetic territories in Argovia was wrested in 1417 from Frederick, Count of Tyrol, who imprudently, supporting Pope John XXIII against the Council of Constance, had been put to the ban of the empire. These conquests Bern could not be induced to restore, and thus completed the independence of the Confederate Republics. The other free cities, though not yet incorporated in the few remaining nobles, whether lay or spiritual, of whom the Abbot of St. Gall was the principal, entered into separate leagues with different cantons. Switzerland became, therefore, in the first part of the 15th century, a free country, acknowledged as such by neighboring states, and subject to no external control, though still comprehended within the nominal sovereignty of the empire. The affairs of Switzerland occupy a very small space in the great chart of European history, but in some respects they are more interesting than the revolutions of mighty kingdoms. Other nations displayed an insuperable resolution in the defense of walled towns, but the steadiness of the Swiss in the field of battle was without parallel, unless we recall the memory of Lake Demon. It was even established as a law that whoever returned from battle after defeat should forfeit his life by the hands of the executioner. 1,600 men who had been sent to oppose a predatory invasion of the French in 1444, though they might have retreated without loss, determined rather to perish on the spot, and fell amid a far greater heap of the hostile slain. At the famous Battle of Sempach in 1385, the last which Austria proceeded to try against the forest cantons, the enemy's knights dismounted from their horses, presented an impregnable barrier of lances which disconcerted the Swiss, till Winkelried, a gentleman of Underwald, commending his wife and children to his countrymen, threw himself upon the opposing ranks, and collecting as many lances as he could grasp, forced a passage for his followers by burying them in his bosom. Though the House of Austria had ceased to menace the liberties of Helvetia, and had even been for many years its ally, the Emperor Maximilian endeavored to revive the unextinguished supremacy of the empire. That supremacy had just been restored in Germany by the establishment of the Imperial Chamber, and of a regular pecuniary contribution for its support, as well as for other purposes in the Diet of Worms. The Helvetic cantons were summoned to yield obedience to these imperial laws. Their refusal to comply brought on a war, wherein the Tyrolese subjects of Maximilian and the Suebian League, a confederacy of cities in that province lately formed under the emperor's auspices, were principally engaged against the Swiss. But the success of the latter was decisive, and after a terrible devastation of the frontiers of Germany, peace was concluded upon terms very honorable for Switzerland. The cantons were declared free from the jurisdiction of the Imperial Chamber, and from all contributions imposed by the Diet. Though perhaps in the strictest letter of public law, the Swiss cantons were not absolutely released from their subjection to the Empire until the Treaty of Westphalia, their real sovereignty must be dated by a historian from the year when every prerogative which a government can exercise was finally abandoned. And thus the Kingdom of the Burgundians of A.D. 407 is represented in the independent confederacy of the Switzerland of today.